Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Chief Sadiq was on the podcast back on episode 35, and at the end I told him we have to do a part two. In this interview, we briefly hit on his Afghanistan project he was tasked to oversee and complete, as well as discussing how the Department of Defense operates their fire and EMS departments, because I never knew and wanted to expand my knowledge. This episode is kind of different from the rest because of how heavily the government is involved with decision-making when it comes to practices and policies. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing how the DoD operates and hope you will as well. And of course, you know I had to ask Chief various leadership questions and his thoughts. So sit back and enjoy the conversation I had with Chief Sadiq. All right, I'm here with Chief Sadiq on a part two. That the first time I had you on here, we said that we would get this going. So we finally, our schedules were able to be aligned. And so I got you here again for a part two. So Chief, first of all, I want to say thank you for coming on again, coming to talk shop.
I appreciate it, man. It's an honor, man. I really appreciate you reaching out to me. They got some construction going on. Is that too much noise?
Nah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's an honor, man. I appreciate talking with you and everything. So, yeah, let's do it.
All right. So before, as we ended our first conversation, you kind of stated about a huge Afghanistan project that even I thought was, I'd love to hear how that goes down. So if you can, let the listeners know how that whole, like, what's involved in getting a project like that start? Because you, I think it was multi-million, or if not mistaken, multi-billion dollar project.
Yeah, well, the fire and emergency services portion of that was $80 million. And I was basically hired by a defense contractor. And you guys may have heard of that, called DynCorp International. And DynCorp had the southern region of Afghanistan. So I was, when I arrived in Afghanistan, there was no fire program at all whatsoever. It hadn't been scoped out or anything like that. And so what wound up happening is I was the chief for the southern region, which includes south, southwest and western regions of Afghanistan, which is an area about the size of Texas, basically. And so what I had to do, it's very interesting how the concepts and ideas are the same. Basically, you look at an area, you identify what the hazards and vulnerabilities are, and you determine what you need in order to mitigate the type of emergencies that would arise in that type of environment. And so in the military, we have, in places like that, a war zone, you have different size installations. We call them forward operating bases, FOBs for short. And so I had to look at all the different types of FOBs. We had five different types, and identify what their mission was and what hazards are associated with this. The highest FOB is one that has tens of thousands of people that work and live on those installations, all the way down to the smallest FOB is, of course, they start banging right now. So the smallest FOB may have maybe 100 or so people. And so you look at those type of installations, you look at their footprint, you identify what the hazards are, and I had to determine what type of assets we needed on ground in order to meet the hazards associated with that particular FOB. And once we identified the assets, of that's the vehicles and equipment type stuff, then that's how I determined how many people, how many firefighters we need to have and what that structure would look like. And then we went out to recruit them. And at the end, when I left, we had over 350 firefighters spread across that region. We had multinational. Now, we had firefighters from South Africa, from Ecuador, from Bangladesh, Philippines, Bosnia, Turkey, Serbia, United States, of course. And one of the things I was really proud of is, and really happy to do, was I actively recruited municipal firefighters from the United States, like yourself.
Okay.
And I'd love to have them come over and experience that life in the wartime environment, being a firefighter and everything. And I think a lot of most of them that I would say all of them actually really enjoyed that experience. They just took a leave of absence from their municipal fire department, came over for a year or maybe two, and then just went back to their fire department back in their municipal in their cities. And one of the things I really enjoyed about having them, and one of the big reasons I actively recruited them, was because in the Department of Defense, we don't have a high volume of incidents regarding fire because we have such an aggressive and robust fire prevention program in the Department of Defense that we can actually enforce codes and things like that.
Okay.
Then we have a very low call volume when it comes to actual fires. We do a lot of EMS type calls, probably commensurate to any other city. And so having those municipal firefighters come into our space and help can help with the training and also help the proficiency levels of the DoD firefighters, I feel anyway. Just because we do a lot of live fire training, but we don't have a actual a lot of calls when it comes to actual fires.
Okay.
Yes.
How was it like trying to get all the different nationalities on board with like certain tactics? Because I mean, firefighters are firefighters regardless, but in different parts of the country and region, there's a different way of doing things. So I'm sure that was a task, especially being able to translate or get them to understand what you're saying. So how much of a task was that?
And it can be difficult, but when it comes to working for the Department of Defense, for the most part, all we have a set criteria on what we require from individuals when they come to work for the Department of Defense. And one of them is they have to be proficient in English,
Okay.
for the most part. Now we do have some that's not in wartime situations, where like we have installations over in Japan where they're not very proficient in English, but we have officers, chief officers that help guide that process. So there are, and then when it comes to tactics and strategies, it just comes with practice with each other and listening to each other's ideas and concepts and just practicing together and working together as a team. And that helps round out those rough edges when it comes to application.
Okay. So you definitely have, because I'd imagine, you know, that for one person to have to handle that, because you said over 350 personnel were hired.
Yes, we had when I left, we had eight departments from different installations all across that region, and each department has its own fire chief. So I was the chief of the entire region, but I had fire chiefs that worked in the different departments, and so each department was a standalone department, and how the chief ran that department was up to them. As long as they stayed within the parameters that were set for the region, then they just ran the department how they felt. And there was some, because I had Bosnian and Serbians, and I don't know if you're familiar with that region, but Bosnia and Serbia were enemies. And Serbia, I had some Bosnian firefighters that were actually prisoners of war under Serbian military. And so there was a lot of friction in some place, and I had to actually separate. I had to pay, okay, if you're serving, you need to go over to this department. If you're Bosnian, go to that department. So I did have to deal with that type of situations, but it turned out pretty well. But yeah, it was over 350, but they're all in different locations,
Right.
so spread across that region.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's certainly not an easy task to be assigned with, but I'm imagining the individuals that you put under you, they understood what your goal was, so then that translated to them understanding it as well, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And because pretty all the chiefs that I had working for each of the departments, they were all DoD personnel. So they were all civilians, but they all were retired military fire chiefs and stuff like that. So they understood what the goal was and what the mission was, and it was very easy. And a few of them were actually my mentors when I was a young firefighter growing up. So it was kind of surreal having them as chiefs, and they call it me chief. You know what I mean? It was very surreal. It made me feel very uncomfortable, actually. But I didn't have much problems with that. Of course, there were a couple of situations where, of course, I had to straighten things out. But for the most part, it was pretty smooth sailing. It was very challenging. It's probably one of the highlights of my entire career. It's probably one of the hardest things I ever had to do. But it was amazing. It kept me on my toes and all that. So,
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I mean, that's no easy task to do. So congratulations on that. And is that program still running today?
no, I believe LOGCAP, it was called the Logistic LOGCAP 4 is what it was called, the Logistic Civilian Augmentation Program 4 for Afghanistan. And no, it has downsized tremendously because we've transitioned out of Afghanistan. But I believe LOGCAP 5 is over in East Africa, I believe, or somewhere in Africa. I can't remember where. But it exists somewhere else. Somebody else had to build that program in that location, but they probably used the same template and everything. So.
So, let's fast forward to now. You're in a new role, a new adventure. So let the listeners know about that.
Okay, so right now I work in Arlington, Virginia. I am one of the four chiefs that make policy and procedure for the United States Marine Corps Fire and Emergency Service. So my actual title is Chief of Fire Prevention. So my job is to develop a fire prevention program for the United States Marine Corps. Right now it's kind of disjointed because there's no set policy that goes across the entire Marine Corps. And so I have to develop a program that actually is standardized across the service, across the enterprise. And then I help with the other different things and training and emergency vehicle life cycle type stuff and different other things. But my primary focus right now is fire prevention. So, chief of fire prevention. Yes.
Without going into too much detail, because I don't know how much you can give away, what are one of your core standards and policies you're trying to enforce across the whole Marine Corps?
Forms, standardizing how we report information, how we gather information and report information. One of the big things that we have to do. What happened was is that there was a big ticket item to fix a fire suppression system or a facility. And this happened maybe a couple of years ago, and it reached up to the two-star general level. And the two-star general asked, "How long has this been going on?" And so came out that it's been a latent condition. It'd been going on for a couple of years. And he asked the question, "Well, don't we have a way for this type of information to reach up here so that we can give it the proper attention?" The answer was no. So what happens was it identifies at the installation, and then it goes to the installation commander and might go to a regional commander, but it doesn't go any further than that because it's not required to. So these conditions don't get rectified. So what I introduced, am going to introduce, and introducing is a way to standardize how things are reported and who needs to see what, depending on the level of risk that we are looking at. And so that's a program that I'm developing now, and hopefully it'll be on the road by the end of the year, maybe early next year. So let's see. But standardizing forms and standardizing that reporting process. I introduced a concept called fire safety deficiencies, which we have, and we definitely have in other parts of the DoD. And that's just conditions that won't cause a fire, but it will increase the risk to property and personnel if a fire should occur. So that's like fire systems down, fire barriers being breached and stuff like that. So they won't cause a fire, but they would increase the risk. So they didn't really have that concept in the United States Marine Corps. So we're introducing it so it can be reported up the chain properly.
Okay. Okay. And so with what you're doing, how, like, I'm trying to figure out what's the amount of personnel in your organization that you have to get this out to?
So there's about 1,000 members of Marine Corps Fire and Emergency Services. We have about, I want to say, can't remember the number, but it's somewhere around 30 installations across the world that we have to, that we manage, basically.
Okay. Okay. So, and for those that don't know, so the United States Marine Corps has a specialized group of fire and EMS. So taken out, because I understand that, you know, you've mentioned earlier that the DOD has a strict rule when it comes to code enforcement, unlike how code enforcement officials here in different organizations and jurisdictions, there's different, like North Carolina has a different rule compared to South Carolina and so on. So for those that don't know, can you explain the type of calls that they go to? Like, is it the standardized EMS calls, and is it only on base, or can they go outside the base?
So installation has their particular response profiles. They do mutual aid. So if there's a community outside the base and we have a mutual aid agreement with the fire department and that has that jurisdiction, then they can respond off base. But mostly they stay within the base confines of the installation. And for a lot of people don't realize that military installations are really cities within cities. We have our own infrastructure. They have everything that you'll find in a city, you find in a military installation. You have your industries, like you have power plants, you have petroleum plants, you have just everything you can find. And so most of our responses are just like any municipality. It's just that we have fewer calls when it comes to fire responses. But EMS calls is actually congruent with the amount of calls that you would have in a municipality, depending on the population. So the bigger the population, the more calls you're going to get. The smaller the population, the less. So it's congruent. It's the ratio is about the same. So.
Okay. Okay. And does the Marine Corps Fire Department service do they conduct their own transport, or is that brought in from the outside?
It depends on the installation again.
Okay. So
some fire departments do transport and some don't. It just depends on what their mission is and what their particular installation commander is willing to accept when it comes to the cost and risk and so forth and so on. So there's a mixture of both.
Okay. Okay. I mean, because I'm new, like this is foreign to me. Like you always hear, and I've had individuals that I know that have taken a time out from their main full-time fire department job to go overseas and do what I would be known, or what I known as, they called it contract firefighting.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Okay. So it's kind of the same like that.
It is. The Marine Corps, you're talking about two different things. Contract firefighters are mostly the firefighters that work in war zones or expeditionary areas where we have forces that go overseas and prepare to go to war, or they are at war. So you can have a fire department, like for instance, I was at Kandahar Air Base. That was a humongous air base. Where war was actually launched from there, right? But then you have over in Qatar, you have a military installation where that's where a lot of staging takes place, but you still have a fire department there. But all those are contract firefighters. You also have military firefighters who wear the military uniform that deploy to those locations. And then the contractors, they normally augment them, or we don't have enough military people to actually do that particular thing. So the DoD contracts an organization to provide that service, right? Now, when it comes to what the steady state or the peacetime is usually civilian firefighters or military firefighters that are stationed at that particular installation. So there's no contract firefighters. It's very few contract departments in the United States in military installations. Very few. Does that make sense?
Yes, I got you now. I got you. And so I'm going to ask to see if my head's going in the right place. So the Marine Corps has their own fire and emergency services. Is it like that in all branches of military government?
That's correct. All branches have their fire departments. Yes.
So the Navy, the
Yes.
Army, all that.
Yes.
Interesting. And I would imagine the standards are kind of the same, right? Like all of them have one specific mission.
Yes, we have a DoD instruction, which is a regulation that tells all components, Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, so forth. These are your parameters. These are the guidelines that you need to follow. And then it's up to the components to determine how they're going to apply that particular standard. So there may be some differences, like for instance, in the Air Force, not all firefighters are required to be EMT, but in the Navy, they may say all firefighters are required to be EMT. And then another one would say, like for instance, the Air Force says that you have to have so many EMTs per shift assigned every day. So the fire chief determines how many EMTs they're going to have on that particular base. So those are the different, how those are applied differently around.
Interesting. Like I said, you don't know what you don't know. So
Yeah.
I wanted to ask. And so when it comes to the Marine Corps with what you're doing, what is the schedule that the firefighters work?
It depends on the base. It depends on the base and the mission and what the firefighters are willing to put up with. So, so you have different you can go to one particular installation and they work one day on, one day off, and so many days off every 2 weeks. And you can go to another one that's 2 days on, 3 days off. It all depends.
Let's switch over to a couple topics that I sent you.
Okay.
So, because if anyone knows you and if anyone's seen your post, you're a big proponent on leadership, on chiefs letting chiefs letting their firefighters be firefighters, but also not trying to don't let them overstep and overrun you, but you have a great outlook on what leadership's supposed to be. So my first question to you is, how do you ensure all members within your organization understand their jobs and their role?
So again, a lot of our structure is very simplistic in its finest, in that we all are given our position descriptions, of course, and then when you arrive, you sit down with your supervisor, and they explain to you what your job is supposed to be, and we're required. It's not an option. You're required to give a quarterly feedback on how the person is doing as versus what the description that they're supposed to be doing. You know what I'm saying? So throughout the year, the person understands and gets reminded of what their roles and responsibilities are. And then of course you get your annual appraisal. So it's kind of pretty clear, and we're reminded every quarter what our roles and responsibilities are. So and there's no option. You can't not do somebody's performance feedback. Because if you don't do somebody's performance feedback, then your supervisor is going to ding you for not doing your performance feedbacks.
Okay.
So
Okay.
it definitely you're held accountable for the things that you're supposed to be doing, and it's very clear in your job description as well as in your performance feedbacks and appraisals what you're doing or not doing in regards to them.
Okay. And I like how you said it. It's non-negotiable quarterly.
Yes, it's non-negotiable. It pops up. It's in a, I guess you call it an information management system type thing, that it pops up and it requires you to respond to that thing on your computer and everything like that. So, and then of
Okay.
course the chief, fire chief is, and the deputy fire chief are looking at this, and they see, hey, so and so, you didn't do the performance feedback. I didn't get a performance feedback for this firefighter. So where's this performance feedback? So it's checks and balances all the way up the chain. So
Right. Okay. No, and I mean that right there will lead it where you can't have an individual hide, or you can't have an individual say, "Oh, I didn't get it,"
right.
because it's known this is non-negotiable. Every quarter this has to be done. I like it.
Right. And it requires the signature of both the supervisor and the person that's the team member. So they both have to go into the system, the computer system, and acknowledge that this has taken place and put their information in. In fact, one of the great things I like about this particular system is that the team member can go in and just write in a journal and say, I did this day, blah, blah, blah. So when it comes to performance feedback, all they got to do is transfer that information over into the form, and there it goes. And so, yeah.
Okay. I like it. I like it. You preach on being a leader and fostering leadership over management. Why is that such an important topic to you?
You know, it's funny when that question is, I never purposely separated those two, but I
Okay.
guess it's natural that they are separated. And the reason why I say that is because my philosophy is that you manage processes, but you lead people. And the difference is that when you're a leader, your primary focus, in my opinion, is that you must care about people, because you care about their growth, you care about their well-being, and you care about them achieving the things that they want to achieve as well, in regard to the organization's goals and objectives, of course, as well. But the primary focus is that you care about people. And if you're a leader that does not care about people, then you probably need to examine or analyze your purpose. Because if you are not doing what's best for the team members and the organization, and you're all about yourself, something's going to break soon. But it's very important that leaders care about people, and they're not there because they want to lead, but they want to help. So.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier, it was kind of an awkward situation of you having mentors that are calling you chief. But looking back at it, would you say those members, when you were coming up and growing up through life, like those were the individuals that you wanted to emulate, and why so?
Yeah, because these are people who demonstrated, and they were chiefs when I was a young guy, you know what I mean? And so they were people who personified excellence. You know, these are people who demonstrated such a profound knowledge in the craft, in the profession, that was a goal of mine to have that type of knowledge and understanding. Now, I have to say that I promise you, and I say this with all sincerity, I never ever had the inspiration or the aspiration to be a fire chief. I never did. After 20 years, I think my first chief post was after 20 years of service. And All I wanted to do was be the best I can possibly be in whatever role that I was given at the time. And so, and when you do that, you're naturally going to continue to rise, because I'm focused on what my goals and objectives are in my particular role. And I want to be the best I can possibly be in that. And then, of course, you become proficient in that. And then somebody, they move you to another section and you become proficient in that. And you just naturally rise. It's a natural thing. But I never, ever, could ever remember a moment when I said I wanted to be a fire chief. And but once I became a fire chief and I recognized those the things that I could help with and motivate people with is a different feeling. It's a different perspective and everything. So yeah.
So the next couple of questions are just for me because I'm very curious on how this goes.
Yeah.
So what is the process to become like a chief officer within DoD? Like, how do they go about that?
Pretty much the same as any other department. You of course you have to have the certifications and the qualifications and the experience. And then of course you apply for a position that comes open and you go through the interview process, your CV or resume, and then you interview for the particular position and they score it. And once if you score high enough, you get the position. That's basically what it is. Now, one of the biggest differences, of course, is that as a federal firefighter, I can go anywhere in the world where there's a military installation. So if there's a position that's open in Italy at one of the several bases that we have there, I can apply for a position there, and then I have to compete against the other candidates for that position. And if I come out on top, I can go to Italy. So that's one of the biggest advantages of being a federal firefighter. So is that. But the promotion process is the same. You just have to do the time. You have to hit the books. You have to understand tactics and strategies. You have to demonstrate your understanding and your proficiency in all the different aspects according to your job performance requirements, and you can continue to rise. Some people are just happy being like any other department. Some people are just happy being firefighters or driver operators or crew commanders. There's nothing wrong with that. But my thing is, if that's all you want to be, that's fine, but be the best one. You know what I'm saying? So.
And my other question, which I think you might have answered it, is there any way an outsider can be chosen? Because you said you have to be a federal firefighter.
No, you don't have to be a federal firefighter. As long as you hold the certifications, the IFSAC or Pro Board certifications, and you demonstrate the experience and the knowledge, you can come from a municipal department and come into the DoD. You can do that. Yes. Yes.
And exactly like rough estimate, you mentioned Italy has a base. Like, how many, like, those are like, I don't want to say exotic locations, but they're locations outside of the US that you could choose if you wanted to get a different perspective. So, how just can you name a few others?
Yeah, I mean, we have wherever there's a military installation. So we have bases in Germany, England, Italy, Portugal, Guam, Japan, South Korea. Where else? Man, we have bases in so many places. Hawaii, of course. The Key West, we have a naval base in Key West, which is pretty nice. They're also actually always hiring. So if any of you people out there, USAjobs.gov. Yeah, you'll see all the different places. So, and then of course, all across the United States, from Maine all the way over to California to Florida. So, yeah. I think where else do we have installations? Well, contracting is over in the Middle East, so you can go to Qatar. Matter of fact, I know a firefighter from an Atlanta firefighter that is actually over in Qatar right now. So I believe, and there's one that I noticed in Saudi Arabia right now as well, working as a contractor. So, yeah.
And if you had to say your opinion, what What's like the hottest installation, or what's the most popular installation to or hard, popular but hard to get to?
It would probably be, I would guess, either England or Italy will probably be the most sought after ones, you know, because they're such central, so centrally located that if you're in Italy or if you're in Europe, you can pretty much go everywhere as far as touristing and stuff like that. So
Okay. All right. I mean, so he, I got another question. It just popped up. If you're a family man, if you have a family, can they go with you?
It
And
depends. They can always go with you, but whether the government is going to pay for it or not, it depends on your level. So if you're a chief officer, then more than likely the government will pay for your family to move. But if you're like a crew commander, call them crew chiefs or lead firefighter, then you will have to pay for their move over there and everything. So,
okay.
but that's also negotiable. You can actually ask the human resources department or the fire chief to request that, hey, if I would love to come, but can you pay for this? And then that takes a whole nother, that's a whole nother process, but it can happen. Yes.
Okay. All right. Next question for you.
Yes, sir.
Regardless of rank, would you agree that chief officers slash admin should accept responsibility of their actions or inactions?
Well, I believe that all human beings, if they reach the age of discernment, have to res accept responsibility for the things that they're responsible for, and they need to take accountability for the things that they do well and the things they do not do so well. And I think that's a that's just a human thing. So it's not just for chief officers or anything like that, but definitely they have to take responsibility. And keep in mind that especially when it comes to chief officers, the responsibility ends with them and accountability ends with them. So whatever happens within their department, if it's in your line, you're responsible for it. It doesn't matter if it was a firefighter, a new rookie firefighter, if that person was down in your area of responsibility, then you're responsible for that firefighter. So yeah, and you need to take responsibility.
Okay. All right.
And that also goes to the about wanting to, like I said, I never wanted to be a chief, but when it comes to, you have to be willing to accept responsibility for things going wrong as well as for things going well. You can't pick and choose. So if things go wrong, you need to have shoulders big enough to carry that thing. It's not all sunflowers and daisies. You know what I'm saying? You have to be able to re accept responsibility for when things are going wrong.
Okay. So I have a personal question because I like how you stated, because I know a few individuals who are in positions now that they were like, if you asked me 5 years ago, hey, would you want this? They tell you no way. So what, as I like to call it, what tripped in your personal breaker that you were like, when you were possibly given that situation to go up for this position, you were like, I'm gonna get out of my comfort zone and do it.
So, what happened was, see, what had happened was, I was the deputy fire chief over at the base we had in Ecuador, and the fire chief was leaving, and to do another position on the installation, and the fire chief said, "I want you to be the fire chief," and I was like, So, okay. I said, okay. So, and that was it. That was the first time I was ever a fire chief, was the fire chief said, "I'm about to move over to this position and I want you to be the fire chief." And he was also one of my mentors, right? So, even though I was the fire chief, I also always had him to lean on whenever I needed some advice about things. And so that was the transition. Now, how I made it the deputy fire chief was the same as I made it to any other position, is that I just did what I was supposed to do in the positions below that. And the next step was just happened to be that's the next step. And so, and then of course, at the deputy fire chief, the next step is fire chief. And it wasn't that I was aspiring to be a fire chief, it just naturally occurred that way. And
Okay.
it's not something that I actively sought, it's just something that naturally happened.
Okay. Side question.
Yes.
With that mentor, being the fire chief, I just want to know, I'm assuming he has full authority where if he knows he's going to go to a different installation, a different site, he can go, "I want you to have it." And then does he have to answer to anybody on that? Or is whatever he says, I mean, as long as you, of course, you fit, you meet the requirements and everything, but he can go to whoever he, I don't know, quote unquote, answers to and go, "I want Chief Sadiq to become my replacement."
So, no, it still has to be a competitive out it has to be go through competitive process.
Okay.
I have to apply for the position and then I'm bounced against other persons. But the advantage I have is that I was already there and I was already a deputy fire chief there. So I already understand what the processes are there. So and then thank God I was good at what I did, what I do. So it was a no-brainer for them. And they didn't have to bring anybody from outside or anything like that. It was just a natural, again, a natural step-up process. But I still had to go against other candidates. But yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, like I said, you're here. I don't know anything about this. I'd like to ask. If I have a question
Yeah,
pop
ask
up,
whatever.
I'm going to ask you.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I'm here for you.
Okay. Let's see here. How do you personally identify, and this is a question due to all your history that you have and experience doing this. So how do you identify weaknesses, inefficiencies, and incompetence that lead to systematic failures within departments?
A lot of that is pretty much key performance indicators, KPIs, standards, bouncing our processes against what the standard is, performance standards, as well as any other type of administrative standards and stuff like that. Are we meeting the looking at that as in regard to what our goals and objectives are? And are those KPIs speaking to the goals and objectives? Are we meeting those goals and objectives? And if not, then that's how we identify what our weaknesses are and where we need to do improvements and so forth and so on. And even if we're doing great and outstanding and excellent, I think one of your other questions was, how do you identify areas of improvement or areas of, I think everything can be improved. And the best way to find areas of improvement is ask the people who are actually doing the processes. You know what I'm saying? So, as a chief officer, I have an idea about things being improved, but the best people to ask are the people who are actually doing the processes because they can actually say, well, we can improve it like this. Now, what I have to do is identify this improvement that they're coming up with, these ideas, how do I fit that? How do we as a department fit that into the strategic plan? And what other things is it going to impact so that I can try to figure out how to make that idea or that improvement enhance the other processes that we have within the department? So, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about as well, as far as when it comes to the thoughts on leadership, is that when I talk about that, is that our purviews are different. So I have different perspectives on things. I was a firefighter a long time ago, but as you become elevate in the organization, you see things from a broader perspective. So it's not just at the company level, whereas the company level may have great ideas, but I have to see how that great idea works its way into the department as a whole. So it's not just sometimes as easy as we're going to do this to change this. We have to figure out how it fits, and we have to make it fit so that it doesn't negatively impact the other processes that we have within the department, whether it's logistics and procurement or the financial budget or safety or anything, all those type things. So I think a lot of times I may say we have to improve this particular process, but the solutions have to come from the people that actually do the processes and everything. And that's where you get these buzzwords like tiger teams and task forces and all that kind of stuff. So.
Okay. No, I like the way you put it. I really do. I do. Personal question I'm going to ask you. If you could do it, or if you had the option to do it, would you transition over and become a fire chief for like an urban suburban department? Like, do you think what you do for the DOD, does it kind of go hand in hand, or would it be like a different road that you'd be taking if you came to a city or municipality not within the government?
It's a good question, man. I think that yes, I could transition to a municipal fire department. I think the personalities may be a little different. I'm not sure exactly how that transition would take place, but I believe that just like a fire chief that's from the municipal can come into a DOD, I think the other way can happen as well. The only major difference between us is the call volume, really. But all the processes we use the NFPA, we use the IBC, we use all the various regulations and OSHA standards that govern fire departments. We use all of them. We've adopted all of them in the Department of Defense. So there's not much difference between us except the actual call volume, really. And then maybe, excuse me, personalities.
Oh
I
yeah,
think,
I could see that being a
So we still have the political type stuff in the DOD, but I think it's more political outside. And I don't have a lot of tolerance for stupid stuff. I really don't.
okay.
And so it, I think I wouldn't bode well with politicians. I don't think that would. And fire chiefs have to be able
I
to
know.
talk to them. I don't have that kind of patience, I don't think, because I'm all about our mission is to protect lives and property from fire. Everything else, as far as I'm concerned, is BS. I don't want to hear about no other crap about why we can't do such and such and such and such. I understand that those things exist. I really do. But yeah, I don't have a lot of tolerance for stupid stuff.
Okay.
I think
So,
fire chiefs actually, if you're listening to this, they know exactly what I'm talking about. So.
right. No, because my next question was going to be, so where you're at now, if you want something or need something for the Marine Corps, I'm sure you have a budgeted item. You list what you need, maybe explain the reasons why. And is it usually a 99% chance, or whoever cuts the check says yes, no issues, no, I have to go down this trail to lead to this trail to get it.
No, it's not 99% yes. It's in fact we compete for dollars across the Marine Corps, across the different services in the Marine Corps. So yes, we have the right strong justifications. We have to tie it into the mission impact on how is it if we don't do this, how does this impact the Marine Corps mission? And so whoever can write the strongest justification for things, that's how you get the dollars. And
Gotcha.
then of course we have congressional laws that tell us how we can spend certain money. And for instance, fire department in the DOD can't spend money on medical things. Only the medical community can spend money for medical consumables and things like that, and then give it to the fire department. But we can't actually go out and buy medical stuff. So it's rules and stuff like that. that we have to remember. But it's not always we need a like for instance, we have vehicles that's out of their life cycle for 10 years plus. And but that was because other things popped up in the mission that required more attention. So yeah, we don't just get money, no. We compete for money. In fact, we have shortfalls of hundreds of millions of dollars across the Marine Corps. So, and we're all fighting for that little scraps and scrapes here.
I got you. So, you know, I think most places that I know, the shelf life of apparatus is about 20 years.
Yes.
Is that something you guys try to follow as well?
15 to 20 years, yes.
All right. And do you have a person that's over like a logistics person that's over like gear and apparatus and things like that? Because you know, with how big you are, I'm assuming that that is a lot to.
Yeah, well, each department manages their PPE and things like that. So each department, so where I am, I don't really worry about the small things like that. We're mostly about policy and program. When it comes to actually doing like those type of logistical things, each fire department and each installation has their logistics officer. They identify their needs according to whatever their standards of cover say, and then that's what they base their budgets on and how they try to justify their budgets as well. So each installation has to justify their budgets as well and try to get money to do the things that they want to do on their installation. So, you know, that's how that works.
You know, FDIC 2024 just passed.
Yes.
And so I'm assuming you've seen the speech by Chief Scott Thompson
Yes.
about the
Risk averse culture.
correct. And you know, he's known in the fire service realm as America's fire chief, along with Chief David Rhodes' revolutionary speech.
Yes.
What were your thoughts on both of those?
I'm 100% on board. You know, change is inevitable. The only thing that I don't really condone change is the structure of the fire department. When it comes to the paramilitary style that we have in the military, because it's very important that you have that structure when you're facing things that are dangerous. So I think that's very important, the rank structure and things like that. But when it comes to changes in championing changes, I think that's very important because things never stay the same. And if you're a department that's the same as you were 5 years ago, you got a problem. You know what I'm saying? And a lot, again, like I mentioned, a lot of change really comes from those people that are actually doing the process. And I think that one of the biggest things that a fire chief can do is look at those concepts and ideas of change that's coming from the members of on the floor, and figure out how to make those concepts and ideas and changes fit into the overall organization. So, again, I think it's very important that we champion change and that we champion ways to improve our processes. And a lot of times that comes from like older people like me. I never thought of that. You know what I mean? That's a great idea. And it's okay that it comes from somebody else. It is okay that it comes from the floor. My job is to try to see if I can make that idea fit. And if it doesn't fit, I have to tell them it doesn't fit, you know, and try to explain to them why it doesn't fit. And these are the problems that we're looking at. And maybe they can help identify how we get through those problems that I'm looking at. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think what they said was right on point. And I wish that there were more chiefs that think like that. And I would argue to say that I would imagine that a lot of chiefs that I know think that way. But there are a few that don't like to change at all. So, but they'll be leaving sooner or later.
I always like to ask anybody that's either served in the military or in the military. So I have heard, I would say I've heard, I don't know how many times I've heard it, but I've heard it enough where it's like I always got to ask. So would you say, like, fire departments that I work for within small counties, cities, municipalities, whether you're large, career, urban or suburban, would you say those fire departments are paramilitary? Because when I hear that, I always kind of like to throw the BS flag because I feel like, you mentioned there are rules and regulations, policies and procedures, but I feel like the non-government type of firefighting organization I work for, if you have said person that doesn't follow the rule that maybe goes around one person to get to this person, if you do that in your military organization, there's consequences for that, right? Not just, oh, we'll look past that or don't do it again.
Eventually, it does happen, and but it consequences will there will be consequences for going around the chain, one way or the other, and whether it's going to be more than likely, it's going to be the person that allowed them to go around the chain. It's not going to be the person that went around. It's going to be the person that allowed them to go around.
Oh,
You know what I'm saying? So
okay.
that's normally what the consequences going to be. But that happens even in the DoD as well. People try to go around the system instead of going up and trying to solve the problems at the lowest level. And but again, this is where, as chiefs, we have to be able to foster an environment where people feel comfortable coming to us with problems without us getting upset that the problem exists. You know what I'm saying? So, and not to shoot the messenger. So I think we have to do a, if you're in a department where that happens, then that means that there's somebody in the chain that is an obstacle for these individuals to air out their grievances, and that should never happen. So.
Love it. Love it. Love it, Chief. Love it. Okay. Personal question.
Yes.
How much longer do you have left to go? And whenever you hit that point where you're like, all right, I'm done signing my papers, what do you see your future? Like, what do you see yourself doing? Will you try to go find, a small town area to become something, or will you just, I'm done, I'm gonna just hang back and just travel the world and chill?
Yeah, I think I'm a chill. I think I'm gonna sit on my couch and play Call of Duty all day. That's what I'm gonna do. That's my favorite pastime, by the way. People wouldn't think that about me, but I love playing Call of Duty. When I go home from work, when I get home, first thing I do is go to the couch, turn on the Xbox, and I start playing Call of Duty. And I'll sit there and I'll unwind. That's how I unwind.
Okay.
And I'll so, but yeah, I don't plan on working anymore. I don't want to work anymore. I worked all my life. I want to. I don't understand people who retire and then go to work someplace else. I don't want to work no more. I want to sit on my couch and watch TV. That's what I want to do. And so, yeah.
Okay. Now, I mean, and I know plenty of people that have done it, and I don't know if it's maybe because they missed the I mean, because like I can say doing what I do, my mind has been programmed now for 17 years of every third day I'm going into work 24 hours. And yeah, I have 2 days off, or I might go on vacation and have a couple extra shifts off, but we, like at least me being active, I always have to do something. So I don't know if maybe that's why individuals do that, because I know that I know plenty of people that leave a place 20, 30, 35 years of service, get a retirement, go work another place for 5, 6 years, establish another retirement, and it's like, damn.
Yes, yeah, and I know quite a few people that way too. I just can't. I worked too much, and I don't want to work anymore once I leave here. So I mean that's just how I see it. But I tease people about that. But yeah, I understand. I just not me. I just wanna chill. In fact, during the pandemic when I had semi-retired, and that's how I wound up over in New Mexico because I had semi-retired and I was just going to do some consulting and stuff like that. Man, the pandemic hit. I couldn't do anything, but I loved being home. I got up when I felt like it, played Call of Duty all day, and I didn't do no work or nothing for a whole year. And but shoot, if I could do that and just, man, that was love. I loved that.
Awesome. Fantastic. Fantastic. So how many more years do you have left?
I have officially 7 years, actually. I have 7 years.
Seven. Okay.
Yeah, that's
Seven
for
years.
retirement from the federal government. I've already retired from the military. So
Okay.
I have 7 more years and I can, and the reason why is because I took a break and did contracting and stuff like that. So that's why I still have 7 years left. I could have been retired if I had actually stayed in the civil service. So, but
Okay. Okay.
yeah.
Well, Chief, I have to say, man, thank you for answering all my questions and opening, because you don't know what you don't know. So when I have a person on here that has life experiences, actually does a different type of firefighting for the Department of Defense. Because you hear DODs all the time, and I've always heard of it, but I never knew what exactly they did. So it's very refreshing for me to speak to you on something outside of what I know. I want to say thank you for taking the time to doing this. And before we part out, is there anything else you want to, any little look at this as instead of what are your thoughts and leaderships on Instagram, you could do a thoughts and leadership on this
Yeah.
podcast. Is there anything you want to say?
Just that, like we mentioned earlier in the conversation, is that leadership is caring for other people and caring about their progress and their well-being. And that's the main component of being a leader. And if you don't have that component of caring about people, then you probably shouldn't be where you are, or you need to re-examine your purpose and your process, your thought process. So, care about people, treat them with dignity, and then keep moving forward. You can always catch my thoughts on leadership, as mentioned, is Thoughts on Leadership, all one word, on Instagram. That's where you can see all the different nuggets and things that I mentioned. So,
Fantastic. Chief, thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your day to do this. I really appreciated it. It was eye-opening, and I learned some stuff today that I did not know. So thank you.
it's my pleasure, man, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. All
All right.
right.
Take care.
You too.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.